final session in the Voice of the Silence. Not that we have by any means exhausted it. So much more could be said. But for those not familiar with the Voice, I hope this has been a kind of inducement to look at it more fully. For those who may have said, oh, it is so very mournful, or so very difficult, or so very, seems so very strict, and so on, it may open up areas that perhaps it is not so difficult, and perhaps not quite as mournful in the path of woe as sometimes depicted. That there is encouragement given all along the way. Throughout, one finds verses that say, have patience, candidate. You know, don't try to do it all at once. You don't have to be the brilliant sun. If sun thou canst not be, then be the humble planet. Give light to others. Even the faintest star on a dark night can seem very brilliant. And so I think again and again it does give us that encouragement. The final fragment three, at the heart of that is the topic that I thought we would discuss today, the paramitas, as they are known. That term has been translated in very many ways. Usually as transcendental virtues is usually the way in which, or virtues of perfection. But I think when one uses that term, virtues of perfection, then immediately one thinks that, well, these are beyond me. And even transcendental virtues gives the feeling that, well, obviously it's not for this life, and therefore I can't do anything about it. So while it is a perfection or an ideal of perfection, I think we have to begin to see that perhaps we can do something about it, and that's why the second question and what I suggest we consider after the break this morning, where do we begin? How do we begin? Where and how do we begin? Are these so remote from us, their practice, that that really we might as well give up before we start, sort of thing. So I'd like to look at them. First of all, of course, the word paramita, it's said, can be divided in two different ways. Para, which means supreme, above, beyond, distant, remote, and mita, which is to move by measured steps. So it is, can be paramita, to move by measured steps to the supreme or to that which is beyond or that which is. In the Voice of the Silence and in other Buddhist literature called the other shore. Param can also mean beyond, and ita, to go. So simply to go beyond where one is. So one can divide the word. It's rather interesting.
In Sanskrit, can it be divided
both ways? Both ways. Mm-hmm. So that it's rather interesting, so that one can see it. Is that right, Rajapan?
Yes, I think
so.
There are a number of Sanskrit idioms like this which can be divided, and different meanings can be given.
Different meanings.
I only ask because if it were in Chinese, it would have different meanings for each syllable, and I wondered whether it would have other.
Yeah. No, this is very true in Sanskrit, and one finds many words in Sanskrit that can be divided differently, giving slightly different meanings than slightly, but essentially the same, but sometimes very different meanings, like Tathagata can mean he who has thus come or he who has thus gone. Yes, both. So there it appears to mean two different things, he who has thus come, he who has thus gone. So depends on which shore of the river you're standing on, whether the bodhisattva traveling across appears to you to be going or coming, you see. From this, so there's often said that what we have to begin to take is the other side point of view, you see, that we must, that we're caught up in the this side point of view. And so we look across the river. And it's rather interesting because again and again this image of crossing to the other shore is used. And it really, you know, is not in one sense foreign to Christianity. You may know that hymn, I can't think of the full title, but about Jordan, crossing over to Jordan and so on. Shall we gather at the river? And there are many hymns, Christian hymns, that have this sort of thing. There's a mystical Jordan that we're going to cross over the river.
One more river to cross.
One more river to cross, yes. This is an image which is used in many traditions. I don't know whether it's used in the Judaic tradition.
That's a Negro spiritual.
It's a Negro spiritual, but I really don't know. But in many traditions, there is this image of the river has been used, and that very often the image that is also used is that we build a raft on this side of the river, but when you get to the other shore, you don't need the raft. Therefore, when you have this other side point of view, abandon then the means by which you have reached the other shore, and so on. So there are many images, and this is certainly very true, because, of course, rivers played a great role, they still do, in India. And the sacred river Ganga and the Brahmaputra and the great rivers of India, which have fertilized, have watered the plains of India. So I suppose this is why.
In the Judaic tradition, the exodus out of Egypt led them up to the banks of the Jordan, at which point every one of them wanted to get out of Egypt, out of slavery, but a lot of them did not want to cross into the Promised Land, so they settled in with the pagan tribes, so to speak, did not make that final step to cross the river to go over and be members of the covenant. They chose to mingle back and kind of compromise. So they had to make one more decision, not just to get out of Egypt, but to cross the river.
To cross the river. That's interesting, yes.
Yeah, very definite step.
That's an interesting, yes, that's true.
Moses went to the brink, and Joshua had to take them across.
That's right, yes.
And some didn't go.
And some wouldn't go, yes. Interesting. So but this symbolism is certainly very prevalent in Hinduism and in Buddhism, the other shore point of view. And consequently, the verse from which I've put the excerpt on the board, verse 206, these portals, you see, the candidate, the aspirant, is asked what he sees. What seest thou before in thine eye, O aspirant to godlike wisdom? I see the path, its foot in mire, its summits lost in glorious light nirvanic. This is verse 205. And now I see the ever-narrowing portals on the hard and thorny way to jnana, to wisdom, to knowledge. Thou seest well, Vanu, or disciple. These portals, which are narrowing, straight is the way and narrow the gate and so on, again, we have that tradition. These portals lead the aspirant across the waters on to the other shore. And you note that to the other shore is in quotation marks in this. And it really it's done that way because it definitely is synonymous with this arrival at the goal, and I think it's in quotes because so many of the books use the Buddhist scriptures use that phrase. Each portal hath a golden key that openeth its gate, and these keys are. Now, one of the interesting things is that HPB gives seven. In most of the, and virtually all the Buddhist scriptures, there are only six. In many Buddhist scriptures, there are 10, of course. Many of the Buddhist scriptures, there are 10. And those 10 are sometimes differently given, even. For example, the first six are always given the same, but the final four are sometimes given differently. The Dalai Lama, for example, in the opening of the Wisdom Eye, gives the 10 quite differently from some of the other Buddhist scriptures. That's so I started to put some of them down, and then I thought, well, there are different ways in which they're given. The first six are generally always given the same. Dana, Sila, Shanti, Virya, Dhyana, and Prajna. Those are always the same, those six. HPB has added one which is not given in any of the Buddhist texts that I have discovered, Viraga. She gives it as number four. It is not given in the ordinary classification. As I say, many are found in later Pali literature. The Dalai Lama gives the additional four as renunciation, determination, truthfulness, and friendliness. Rather interesting. We've already talked about friendliness in the sense of the Kalyana Mitra, the good friend, or metta in the Pali, which is to be the good friend. So I thought we might look at them in a different way in which you can combine. You can see them as pairs.
Excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
Back a bit.
Mm-hmm.
After, to the other shore.
Mm-hmm.
Is a question mark. Is that just a...
No, that shouldn't be. That's number seven. It's a reference to... Reference to... Yes, it's a reference to the note in the notes at the conclusion of the voice. Uh-huh. And that reference is to the fact that arrival at the shore is with the northern Buddhists synonymous with reaching nirvana through the exercise of the six and the 10 paramitas, virtues. And HPB mentions 6 and 10 occasionally. So that is mentioned. But I think that for our purpose, so that's not a question mark, but the just a reference point. Well, I think looking at them in pairs can be rather interesting. By noticing that there are four fetters, it is said, four things that bind us to this shore, to this side. And the first of the fetters is kama, which is desire, passion, love that is selfish, attachment to wealth, to possessions, position, and so on. The cure for that is dana, which is the first of the paramitas as generally given. In fact, in all the texts, dana is given first, always. Which is not simply an outer charity. Notice HPB translates it, the key of charity and love immortal. I think, actually, we're familiar with that word. We use the word donor, donation, and so on, which is the same word, because Sanskrit, of course, is part of the Indo-European language. And so we find words that are similar in English. And dana, as caring, as giving, is the same word that we have in donor and donation and so on. But it's not simply an outer charity. It's a total caring in which one uses all that one is not all one has, but all one is for the welfare of others. Dana has been called a constant radiation of one's being. It's an openness, a willingness to give of oneself, doing whatever is required in any situation, at any moment. It reflects itself then in an inner attitude of generosity, without judgment as to whether others are worthy or not. An attitude then of non-possessiveness, a complete communication of generosity, if you like. It's love and compassion without irritation and without rejection. In one of the Buddhist texts of the Prajnaparamita, whole corpus of literature, the Prajnaparamita family of writings, which is a huge group of writings, as you may know, and in one of the Prajnaparamita writings, the Mahayana Shraddhapada Shastra, which is usually translated as the awakening of faith in the Mahayana, it said, how should one practice charity? And this is the response. This is credited to the great Buddhist scholar of the first century, Asvaghosha. Yes, thank you. How should one practice charity, dana? If someone comes and asks for anything, disciples, as far as they are able, should grant the request ungrudgingly and in a way to benefit them. If disciples see anyone in danger, they should try every means they have to rescue him and impart to him a feeling of safety. If anyone comes to disciples desiring instruction in the Dharma, they should, as far as they are able and according to their best judgment, try to enlighten him. I think one could translate that. If somebody comes and asks you what is theosophy, you should try as best you can, as far as you're able, to answer, you see. And that's dana. And when they are doing these acts of charity, they should not cherish any desire for recompense or gratitude or merit or advantage nor any worldly reward. They should seek to concentrate the mind on those universal benefits and blessings that are for all alike, and by so doing will realize within themselves highest perfect wisdom. So dana can be joined then, and it's complemented by the last of the paramitas, prajna, which is wisdom born of right knowledge, or compassionate wisdom. Prajna is that wisdom that requires us to act in terms of universality, from an attitude centered in unity. So dana and prajna combine to transmute or overcome kama, desire, into wise and generous action. And so it said, how can one practice intuitive wisdom, prajna? When one, by the faithful practice of dhyana, attains to samadhi, he has passed beyond discrimination and knowledge. He has realized the perfect oneness of mind essence. With this realization comes an intuitive understanding of the nature of the universe, and he now realizes the perfect oneness of essence, potentiality, and activity in Tathagatahood. So the two go together. I think they complement each other. What we can call wise and generous action. Then one acts in the world, but one knows what is the right action because one acts from universality, from wisdom, compassionate wisdom. So from that union of dana and prajna, wise generosity, there come the pair, it said, is born the complementary pair of sila and dhyana. Now, HBB defines sila, the key of harmony in word and act, the key that counterbalances the cause and the effect and leaves no further room for karmic action. And dhyana, of course, whose golden gate once opened, leads the Nalgir, the adept, toward the realm of Sat Eternal and its ceaseless contemplation. And so we can see these as the essence, Srila, as the essence of harmony in speech, action, and relationships, achieved through ceaseless contemplation, contemplation of the One. Now, as again, the fetter, we're dominated by krodha, which is hatred born of conflict. It's bewilderment and it's anger, wrath, often. So conflict is resolved by awareness of a principle which always seeks to restore harmony, equilibrium. And once we are aware of that, this is why it leaves no further room for karmic action. One is aware that there is always the lawfulness that is restoring balance, that is bringing about harmony. So the antipathies, the animosities, the jealousies between individual and individual, nation and nation, grow out of a confused and chaotic mind of the individual caught up in the grip of likes and dislikes and, you know, maybe not active hatred, although certainly at the national levels there frequently is active hatred, isn't there? But the jealousies between individuals, which is also krodha. It's the antipathies, the animosities that lead to conflict in personal relations, individual relationships. And we get caught in that. But Srila, which is moral conduct, often called the perfection of morality, grounded in dhyana, which is the contemplation of the essential nature of things, then enables one to act always from that inner harmonious center of one's being with absolute confidence. You remember we spoke last time, I think it was, about Shraddha and the importance of Shraddha or confidence. As of course, it's translated as confidence in at the feet of the master, and it's translated often as faith in Shankaracharya's crest jewel, the Vega Chudanami. So it is that confidence, absolute confidence in the law that adjusts and balances all opposites. For moral conduct, in other words, Srila, arises out of dhyana, or that wakefulness. You remember the path of giving attention. One gives attention, that wakefulness in which one is all the time giving attention. To be awake is to contemplate everything as it really is, to see the world as it is, without any preconceptions, without blinds, without veils. It's to perceive without distortion. Imagine if we could really look at each other without distortion, without any of the blinds that we bring down. So you act then in harmony with that interior vision. So it is it's morality, the right conduct, which then arises because one is in that condition of ceaseless contemplation. I think HPB's words that the realm of Sat Eternal, the realm of the real, and its ceaseless contemplation. One is constantly attentive to it. Consequently, one's conduct is always the right conduct. It's been also said in this regard that it's that we act in accordance with that openness. And so it's been said, the metaphor that's been used is the bodhisattva's conduct is like the walk of an elephant. Elephants do not hurry. They just walk slowly and surely through the jungle, one step after another. They just sail right along. They never fall, nor do they make mistakes. Each step they take is solid and definite. So if we can learn to walk like elephants, perhaps, This is the kind of deliberate but absolute assurance in the rightness of the law, that there will is the balancing. Then, of course, the wise and generous action, dana and prajna, which are reflected in right conduct, shila, that conduct which is always in harmony with the perception of the one reality in all things, lead inevitably to shanti, which has been called, as H.P.B. says, patience sweet that naught can ruffle. Marvelous. Patience sweet that naught can ruffle. And virya, dauntless energy. She says, she calls it the dauntless energy that fights its way to the supernal truth out of the mire of lies terrestrial. And so this is that kind of patience that never expects anything, that never fears new situations, that is, it's a kind of patience that feels space, if I can put it that way. That there is space, that there's a space between the situation and oneself, as it were. It's one way of looking at it. And so it means that we have a flowing relationship with the world. Just as wise and generous action and conduct in harmony with the inner realization of the oneself transmutes conflict and hatred, so patience combined with spiritual energy releases us from the fetter of moha, which is illusion born of ignorance. Can be translated in, it's confused mind, isn't it? A confused mind. How would you translate it, Rajapan, moha? It's a confusion of mind?
Moha is actually desire for more.
Desire for more.
See, you've got $1 million, you want 10 million, you want, you know,
yes.
That sort of book.
I think also it's been translated as bewilderment.
Good. See, actually karma is, you know, mm-hmm. animal passion.
Yes.
Krodha means anger.
Anger.
Without any reason.
Yes.
And moha means this desire for more.
Yes.
More.
And also, according to the Sanskrit dictionary, can mean bewilderment and one is very confused, the confused mind. So that patient...
That is a little different. Vyamoha.
Yes.
That is what you said.
Yes, no, yes. So patience really means, as I say, that we have a flowing relationship with the world. We don't sort of build dams at any point and restrict the flow of our relationship with the world. We don't have to fight anything. You know, I think it gives us a marvelous feeling. We don't really have to fight anything. I think sometimes we fight imaginary windmills like Don Quixote, you know, and to go out there and want to slay the dragons all at once. And sometimes, while this doesn't mean we sit back, because it's combined with virya, which is a spiritual energy that therefore acts in the right way, but we don't have to be full of anxiety or fear or wrong expectations. I think with patience, we're not driven by premature impulse or by the instinct to force people to change right away, you know. Be what I think you ought to be right now, sort of thing. And we don't have to force people and events into rigid patterns that we think are right. It's a patience, as I say, however, that's joined with virya, that dauntless, unruffled, purposeful, and one-pointed spiritual energy, which provides the inner strength to face all opposition, all dangers, with a purity of heart and a confidence, again, Shraddha, in the ultimate triumph of that which is right. So we have then this kind of energy that is a joyous energy. We work hard because we want to work hard. It's been said, therefore, that the Bodhisattva never wastes one second. He lives life thoroughly and fully, and the result is that before he realizes where he is, he has attained enlightenment. So it's a working hard with a joyousness. Again, quoting from the Prajnaparamita text, how should one practice forbearance, shanti, it's been translated patience, forbearance, as one meets with the ills of life, he should not shun them nor feel aggrieved. Patiently bearing evils inflicted by others, he should cherish no resentment. He should neither be elated because of prosperity, praise, or agreeable circumstances, nor depressed because of poverty, insult, or hardship. Keeping his mind concentrated on the deep significance of the Dharma, he should under all circumstances maintain a quiet and equitable mind. And how should one practice courageous vigor, virya? In the practice of good deeds, one should never become indolent. He should look upon any mental or physical suffering as the natural following of unworthy deeds done in previous incarnations, and should firmly resolve that henceforth he would only do those things which are in keeping with a spiritual life. Cherishing compassion for all beings, he should never let the thought of indolence arise, but should ever be indefatigably zealous to benefit all beings. So it's interesting to combine the two. In regard to virya, this dauntless energy, however, I think of the story of an individual who examined what we in the West, of course, are so fond of calling the work ethic. And many of us have grown up, I suppose, with that so firmly embedded in us that I think this is typically a Western sort of trait and maybe a very Puritan sort of trait, that you shouldn't ever be, caught just sitting still. Maybe it's something sometimes we have to overcome if we do much meditation, that, should I be doing something else, or should I be involved somewhere, and so on. And this particular individual, this was reported in a journal published by the Society of Friends, the Quakers. This man was repeating his own experience that he really was realizing that he was headed for a heart attack or stroke or something of that nature. So he tried to get an understanding of what he called the pressuredness of work. He was repairing something in his basement, and he became aware that this pressure was building up in him. And I think we've all had this experience where a kind of interior pressure builds up, and I've got to do this, I've got to do this, and I've got to get it finished, and I must get it finished by 5 o'clock or whatever, and so on. And much as he tried to stop, he could not. But finally, he just forced himself to put aside the task midway to completion. He went away, he had a cup of tea. I don't know whether he lived in New Zealand or Australia or South Africa, but he must have, you see. A cup of tea solves all things, doesn't it?
It's actually terrible
stimulant. Well, in those countries, the only reason they ever have lectures and so on is so that the space is out, the cups of tea that are constantly being served. maybe in Finland he went off and had a sauna. To the sauna.
or coffee,
yes. And he, doing that, he reflected on the immense power of the drive that had gotten the grip of him to get this job done. And when he faced that, when he really looked at this tremendous drive that had built up in him and looked at it, in other words, gave himself space between the task and this feeling, he went back to the task and he found, he said, an amazing difference in the manner of his work. In fact, he said, it became like a dance, as though something within him said, see, now, you're participating in the dance of the cosmos in sawing this wood. So it's an energy that is not a a driving energy, but it's a spiritual energy that continually flows through us.
Well, it seems like when this wrong movement starts, the self starts. Mm-hmm. You know, my personal likes or dislikes. Then he would get back into the movement of the wholeness of it, yes.
But I thought the illustration,
That's a really good illustration.
It's a marvelous illustration, because I think sometimes we all do at some time or other get caught up in this kind of frenzy of something that must be done. And we're going to do it. And then we lose the sense of, well, I think of the terms that Nancy has often used, that instead of saying working at something, playing at something. So we lose the sense of play, that, all right, I'm playing with this. This is a dance. And my movement then can be that, and it can be purposeful. It can have energy in it.
And joyous then, yes.
It becomes joyous, this is the thing. So that virya is really a joyous energy. And in some of the texts, it really is translated as that, a joyous energy, which is present. And I think that one can begin to see this. It's joyous energy because we're completely interested in the creative patterns of our lives. One's whole life, then, is opened by generosity, activated by morality, strengthened by patience, and now one arrives at this stage of joyous energy. And then, of course, HPB gives us this fourth one, which is, I say, and it's rather interesting that she includes it. It is not part of the Buddhist tradition, per se, although it's not absent from that tradition, but it is much more a part of the whole tradition of Shankaracharya, for example, in the Viveka Chudanami, the qualification of viraga, which is simply to be without color. That's what it means, without color, no color. And so, here it permeates, it's central, it stands alone. HBB calls it indifference to pleasure and to pain, illusion conquered, truth alone perceived. And so it's a kind of what we can call, I think, a sublime equal-mindedness, which provides balance and equanimity. Bound as we are, of course, in the entanglements of life, shuttling between pain and pleasure, suffering and joy, we have the fetter of lobha, which is covetousness or avarice born of possessions, a kind of greed always. Really all of these are kama in one sense there, but lobha is this covetousness. I want what you have, I want that. And so here, viraga, I think, overcomes that. May?
Where are they in the
Puja? The fetters are not in here. So I have added that. But it seems to me it's a way of looking at this. No, HBB doesn't mention the fetters, but it occurred to me that you can group the paramitas into these three pairs, and then viraga, which really is the middle one, she gives it as number four, you see, and which is not in the customary listing of the six. These are the customary six paramitas as given in the Buddhist texts. She adds this one, she adds it as number four, so I've put it there as central. So there, these are operations which are really functions, ways in which we function, one can say. It's the mode in which we are in the world and training us in an ethical way which develops naturally, not by commandment, so to speak, But by then developing, because of this interior knowing which arises within us, and therefore they are said to carry us. These are what carry us to the other side, give us, if you like, the other side point of view. I'm seeing if there was some other. They're all interdependent, and while they're given, of course, HPB gives them 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. She uses Prajna, she uses Viraga as fourth, and therefore gives 7 of them. They're not to be developed one after the other. One doesn't find oneself giving all of this attention to dana, to generosity, and so on, but rather that they're developed simultaneously and inevitably, just as in the whole cycle of dependent origination, the whole, the nidanas as they're called, the causes of misery, one arises, the other arises, they all arise. So in that sense, they all are interrelated. When one moves from a position of total caring, for example, if you really totally care, dana, if you not just giving, it's not just charity, I'll give away what I no longer need sort of thing, but I totally care for everything because I recognize there is only one life, because I'm seated in that reality, because of that ceaseless contemplation, then obviously I'm going to be patient, and obviously I'm going to act in a way that is the right action at the right moment, and so on. So, yeah.
Well, it seems like when I've been able to do that, I've had a sense of sufficiency.
Yes.
That what I parted with was a flowing thing, and not, oh, should I? Oh, should I not? Oh,
yes.
I needed that. I could have used that. You know, no conflict.
Yes, that's right. But once one really is in that flowing relationship with the world, too, which is Srila, and that fully flowing relationship, then one is generous. One is open.
But don't you have to have that sense of sufficiency to be generous? If you have the sense I have to do this, or I have to deny myself, then that isn't coming.
That's very true. I think there must never be, and that's why I think we misunderstand this word virtue. You know, I must be virtuous, sort of thing. I must be good today, you know. It's interesting how, you know, some years ago, I wish I could remember all of the phrases, but there was a work that dealt with the way in which we train our children and in different cultures. And in our culture, we say to the child, be good. But there are cultures which say to the child, be happy. There are other cultures that say other things, be manly or be womanly.
Stay in line.
Stay in line, yes. The Germanic, Teutonic culture is often stay in line. The French culture, I think, is very often be happy. Ours is be good. So it's not in that sense, but it's that once, so that these are so interconnected, I think, one begins to see that one of them inevitably gives rise, sufficiency, if you like, it's a feeling, but also when one is really, truly centered in the awareness that there is only one. So it's not in that sense, but it's that once, so that these are so interconnected, I think, one begins to see that one of them inevitably gives rise, sufficiency, if you like, it's a feeling, but also when one is really, truly centered in the awareness that there is only one life, that there is, you know, then one doesn't become impatient, or one is, or when one feels this interior energy of the genuine self, then one acts in a way that is harmonious, or when one simply does an action because it's the right action at the right moment, and you know that it was the right action at the right moment, there comes this sense of openness and patience and energy and so on. So I think any one of them begins to lead to the others. And you told Evelyn that most of words in various languages. Rajapan reminded me that usually vairagya is V-A-I. I put the spelling there that HPB used in the Voice of the Silence, the V-I-R. But usually it is spelled differently. The A-I, which is I, by. But that's interesting that in Hungarian then there's a viraga which is many colored flowers and so on. So in a sense this is...
I'm glad that you put the I-A-I in there.
Yes.
Because when I saw the word,
mm-hmm.
and you said it's colorless.
Yes.
And I thought virago, certainly.
There are a couple of other quotes I thought I might just present. In one of the texts, the what is called the etymology of the perfections is given in this order. It is called liberality because it abolishes poverty. Ethics, because it leads to coolness, which is interesting. One is cool. Patience, because it endures harshness. Strenuousness, which is virya, because it applies itself to what is most sublime. Meditative concentration, because it holds the mind in its own inner sphere. And discriminating awareness, born of wisdom, because by it the ultimately real is known. So again, one sees this kind of interdependency of them. One of the other texts, the text by Arya Asanga, one of the great pupils of the Buddha, puts it, by not clinging to wealth or pleasures, which is dana, by not clinging to wealth or pleasures, by not cherishing any thoughts to violate the precepts, Ashila, by not feeling dejected in the face of evils, which is, and incidentally, sometimes shanti is translated as meekness, as well as patience, meekness. So by not feeling dejected in the face of evils, by not awakening any thought of indolence while practicing goodness, by maintaining serenity of mind in the midst of disturbance and confusion of this world, and finally by always practicing ekacitta, which is one mind or one heart, one knowing, and by truthfully comprehending the nature of things, the bodhisattvas recognize the truth that there is nothing that is not of ideal or subjective creation. And then one of the other texts has it. The bodhisattva practices the virtue of charity by freely giving away to all sentient creatures all the merits he has acquired by following the path of Buddhas. So there is this concept one finds in Mahayana Buddhism that of a transfer of merits, that by my being good, as it were, by my being generous, you benefit, and it becomes your merit in that sense. So freely giving away to all sentient creatures all the merits that he has acquired by following the path of Buddhas. He practices the virtue of good conduct, Shila, by destroying all the evil passions that disturb serenity of mind. He practices the virtue of patience, shanti, for he never gets irritated or excited over what is done to him by ignorant beings. We might pause there. Evelyn reminded me that in Mongolia, do you want to mention that? The five
sins are lust, anger, greed, envy and stupidity.
And stupidity, yes. So we can say all of these together overcome stupidity. Perhaps we could add that. But he practices the virtue of patience because he never gets irritated or excited over what is done to him by ignorant or stupid beings. He practices the virtue of strenuousness, virya, for he never gets tired of accumulating merits and of promoting goodwill among his fellow creatures. He practices the virtue of calmness, dhyana, for his mind is never distracted in steadily pursuing his way to supreme knowledge. He practices the virtue of intelligence, prajna, for he always restrains his thoughts from wandering away from the path of absolute truth. Of course, that's real meditation. Then this particular text goes on to name the others in the 10, naming them slightly differently from the way they're often given. He practices the virtue of tactfulness, upaya, which is really skillful means, but here translated tactfulness, for he has an inexhaustible mine of expediencies ready at his command for the work of universal salvation. I rather like that. He has an inexhaustible mine of expediencies. We know how to act in every single situation. Imagine that. We have this inexhaustible collection, storage of expediencies. What is expedient, which is what is right at the moment. Ready at his command for the work of universal salvation. If this doesn't work, then I'll do something else, in other words. He practices the virtue of will to do, pranidhana, by determinedly following the dictates of the highest intelligence. He practices the virtue of strength, bala, for no evil influences, no heretical thoughts can ever frustrate or slacken his efforts for the general welfare of people. Finally, he practices the virtue of knowledge, jnana, by truthfully comprehending and expounding the ultimate nature of beings. So you can see there are many ways that these have been translated.
What text is there that gives the numbers? Refer to them as numbers, these things.
Numbers?
Well,
they're numbered. This is in Suzuki's Outlines of Mahayana Buddhism. And of course, HPB gives them numbers, you see, in the Voice of the Silence.
She numbers. Copy of the Voice of the Silence, but it doesn't have any numbers.
Oh, well, in the original text, she did number them, you see. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. But many of the texts have been edited and so on, do not have them. But they were in the original text. So there are many ways that one can begin to see them. As I say, she herself, in some of the translation, points to the virtues 6 and 10 in number, and yet when she comes to give them, you see, she gives them as 7. But earlier on, she has spoken of the, the virtues, yes, the paths are true. The great perfections 3, 6 are the virtues, but later she had said 6 and 10 are the virtues. I don't find the exact reference. But then she gives them as 7, you see, by adding viraga. And in later Pali literature, one has others that are added. The Dalai Lama, for example, gives others, as I've said, friendliness, metta, renunciation, nekama, determination, which can also be added to it, adhisthana, which is sometimes translated as inflexible courage, and upeksha, discrimination, the right method for acting, and sometimes the 10th paramita is given as prabodha, meaning awakening of the inner consciousness, and sambuddhi, a complete and perfect illumination, and so on. So there are various ways. Well, I thought, now, any comments now on all of these? Does it help to put them in this particular order? Roger.
They all seem so familiar to me. I recognize now that they line up very, very well with Tanjali Sutras,
mm-hmm.
as they are used in the Hindu Shankaracharya tradition.
Yes.
Which has come down to us in the Transcendental Meditation Movement, one form of that.
Mm-hmm.
They present the sutras of Patanjali in very much the same fashion.
Mm.
And they're used in a meditative state to try to culture those virtues on a deep, deep level, not just on a conscious level, but on a meditative level.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And those are the very same virtues or powers or skills, whatever you want to call them,
mm-hmm.
That are promoted by those sutras
mm-hmm.
from Patanjali.
Yes. All together, you see, these do represent the upaya, that skillful means by which karuna and prajna are joined, compassionate wisdom. These are the skillful means, upaya, which is always necessary. Any other comments or points anyone wants to make about them? I really didn't know how to phrase the questions that I thought might be useful for us to consider. So I finally put it just, first of all, how can we know the other shore from this shore? How can we understand what is meant by the other shore point of view? Is there any way by which we can come to that point of view which is called the other shore point of view? Well, we're still on this shore.
Would it be through meditative techniques?
Certainly.
Possibly?
I think that would certainly be one way, yes. Certainly in a very valid way, through meditation.
Well, I don't know if we're really on the shore. I think we're sort of in the stream. They say we've already entered the stream.
Mm-hmm.
And to know whether we get the other shore, I think maybe that's what we talked about yesterday about the points,
mm-hmm.
that we can't depend on any kind of gray card or any kind of points of rites of passage in the usual sense of anything that you can celebrate or anything that you can look at or other people, you can get feedback from other people, that it's just your own knowing. And just to get personal about it, I look, going back to this literature over a period of maybe several years, and how it changes, and how new things come out, mm-hmm. and how new understandings act as points for me to know, you know, what I'm doing, how I'm going,
mm-hmm.
if I'm going anywhere. And so how far we are in the stream, or whether we get to the other side, or when we get to the other side, is are trusting ourselves.
Mm-hmm. I think that's very true, and I think you're absolutely right, Lowell. We really are in the stream. We're not just on this shore. We have entered the stream. Once thy foot hath pressed the bed of the nirvanic stream, this is the very fact that we have awakened to the fact that there is a stream, we're in it. So we begin to see then that there is that other side.
So it would be the beginning of awareness, in a way.
In a way it is, yes. It is a beginning of awareness, yes. Murray?
I feel that any state which tends to a universal outlook, as opposed to personal one, that's one keynote or one sign of that other viewpoint.
Yes, certainly any state, any consciousness of, that is universal, that has a quality of universality. Yes.
I thought maybe if we give a little bit more space to the unknown and just make that part of our life, then some things will necessarily start showing something.
I think that's a beautiful way of putting it. Mm-hmm. Give space to the unknown, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And not being fearful then of it, not being anxious about it. I think so often we, you know, there's a kind of thing, well, if I do that, what's going to happen? We sort of want to know what the outcome is going to be instead of being willing to face the unknownness of that and do what may need to be done. And I like that, giving space to the unknown.
Well, we're giving space to the unknown, recognizing when fear is starting to enter. We're not giving space to the unknown.
No.
If that other comes about, mm-hmm. Right?
That's true, yes. We become anxious. You know, it's not the first step that bothers us, it's the second step sort of thing.
I think some books keep on asking yourself questions. You might not be able to get the right answer, but by constantly asking yourself a question, or you're trying to locate the spirit within yourself, so you can't. But most of the questions you would ask yourself might be in a negative. Mm-hmm. So one way to do it would be to twist them around and see what they were if you put them in a positive thing, mm-hmm. or ask them in reverse, and in the hope that you'll find your spirit giving you an answer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. On a purely personal level, can an intuitive leap get you over there?
Why not? I think an intuitive leap often does. I think that's the whole thing of an intuitive leap, and we do have these leaps, don't we?
I think we get these leaps in darshan when we're sitting with somebody who is of lofty thoughts. Or
well, there may be many ways, yes. Yes.
To learn how to swim.
Actually, the other shore is supposed to be already part of our collective.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. It's.
Yes, because I think you get glimpses of it. When you've done something that's hard to do, and you get a feeling of, I use the word righteousness, and I say that, you know, I'm quoting mm-hmm. a smile, but this feeling of the joyousness that comes with having, say, divest yourself of something you really want,
mm-hmm.
because you know mm-hmm. you'll need it,
mm-hmm.
that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, that's why I asked you, see, the second question, in a sense, where or how, where and how do we begin?
Aren't we already begun?
Or we've begun, yes. All right. We're already on the way. What do we do next then? Or do we do anything next?
This makes me think of the chicken and the egg. You know, why does the chicken break out of the egg?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
We are, and this other side must be the most powerful magnet known to mankind, because we're all being drawn towards
mm-hmm.
it. So therefore, I think it's inevitable as growing old, as you know, childhood following, adolescence following childhood, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
It's just essential. It's a matter of time, perhaps. It's not fast.
How fast we go.
Mm-hmm. Using the analogy of the river, recognizing the rocks and the waterfalls and the
yes.
the obstacles.
Yes. Yes. Sometimes we sort of get carried over the edge of the waterfall, don't we?
How to maneuver around skillfully is part of the journey.
That's right.
And maybe being willing to really take stock of yourself,
mm-hmm.
really to look
mm-hmm.
closely and without fear of what you might see.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm.
And to see what you have to work with and
mm-hmm.
what you can do to
mm-hmm.
do a little more, to
mm-hmm.
change, to transform.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I like the term readiness.
Mm-hmm.
This is a lot of these.
Yes. The readiness is all, as the Pennsylvania Dutch put it. The readiness is all. That's it. And it is.
Another way of expressing Mary Jo's thoughts is to start where we are.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Take us off right now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Kala Rinpoche gave a talk on third eye, an opening of the third eye.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that the opening of the third eye corresponds to the first movie, the first level of first ground of the first paramita, which would be generosity. In the Tantra, in the highest yoga Tantra, it says that they talk about the opening of the energy points and so on, and they correspond to white drops. And they say there's a total of 3,600 white drops. When you enter, when you reach that level of dana, that would be half of the drops already. So that'd be 1,800 drops. And that would correspond to about the heart chakra. So half the battle is won.
Half the battle is won.
You can open up to the generosity, and then just applying skillful means and your meditational type of awareness, it's a matter of just compounding that and perfecting. But that's my estimation.
Yes.
The place to begin would be with generosity.
I feel that too very often, that really if one cared deeply enough for everything, one really cared, then everything else would fall into place. You know, that when one felt the, what I like to call the preciousness in everything, every event, every person, every sentient being, there's a preciousness, and one cares very deeply for that.
Is that the compassion of nature?
Yes, but it's then one acts out of a generous openness, because one cares so deeply. It's true, it's always as taking stock of ourselves, where one suddenly says, well, now why did I feel I had to be first in line? Or why did I feel I had to get upset with that person who tried to get in ahead of me, or tried to, you know. Even practicing it, I find becoming aware when you're driving, and how do you react if somebody swerves in front of you?
You're all alone in the car and no one can hear.
No one can hear, yes, that's right, you know. And, you know, and sometimes, it's funny, sometimes I just get so provoked, and other times, I don't care whether I get there, you know.
You're thankful you didn't have an accident.
Yes, that's right. Yes. But it's very true, and one sort of does take one stock of oneself.
A drop of water and the ocean.
How do you mean, Anthony?
Well, the ocean becomes the drop of water.
The ocean, the whole ocean is there in the drop of water. Yes, and the drop of water is in the ocean.
I found out there was a certain way you can use the personality to help yourself. Well, my son wanted to, wanted me to wear a tuxedo, which was 10 months later, and he wanted me to be a size 34, so I said, okay, I'll arrange to have that size 30. And it took me 10 months to trim my stomach to get it down that way. But I actually had pleasure on the way. I was realizing that I was not as uncomfortable, and actually I enjoyed the idea of, I'm getting thinner, I changed my personality a lot, and it was marvelous when I reached there and actually accomplished it. Something that I didn't have to do it, I thought it was the right thing to do it at the right time,
That's real care.
That's real, real caring, real caring.
I suppose also we can begin by becoming more sensitive, this means experiencing consciously things which we do not like very much, and sometimes not at all, in order to also be able to experience those things that are really most precious.
It is, and it is a sensitivity, isn't it?
But if you shut out one kind, you shut out everything.
Everything, yes. So it is an openness, yes. But there is that sensitivity.
The Buddha speak about losing a self-cherishing attitude. It's such a beautiful phrase.
That's a beautiful phrase.
Self-cherishing attitude, yes. That we all have. Trying to
slowly let go of that,
yes.
So that we are sensitive to mm-hmm. everything around us, like you yes.
That is a beautiful phrase, the self-cherishing. Because we do like to protect ourselves. We don't want to be hurt, of course. We resist being hurt. We don't want to, things to happen to us that seem to diminish the self. I like that phrase, the self-cherishing. Jocelyn, did you?
I was thinking that we need to try and dissipate our intensity.
Mm-hmm.
As we strive, we become rather centered.
Mm-hmm.
And in caring so much, in fact, what Mary Joseph said is terribly relevant.
Mm-hmm.
We tend to get blinkered
mm-hmm.
and intense, and we're really trying to be good and be on the path and love everybody. And
yes.
And it gets like this, it gets frantic.
Yes.
And we can just relax
mm-hmm.
and.
Mm-hmm.
And allow things to happen, not have to always be in control,
mm-hmm.
but trust in this oneness
mm-hmm.
that we all belong to,
mm-hmm.
to nurture us as we try to nurture it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So this is a two-way process.
There is a two-way process in it, isn't there? Very much so. Because the universe nourishes us and we nourish the universe. But we don't have to be so intense about it. We try so hard.
That's why I especially like the combination of Ashanti and Viriya.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that's our home because it really shows the balance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. Patience with energy, energy with patience. John, were you starting to say?
Well, I was thinking about what she said, the word perfection meaning paramitas, or paramitas meaning perfection. About a month ago, I was thinking about this course and whether I wanted to come up. So I went in the Salvation Army, and hanging on the wall was a mirror, a small mirror, and it had a little frog painted on the mirror, and above it says, "Nobody's perfect." And I got a laugh out of that. And here I am.
And here you are. I'm glad you decided to come up, John. It's wonderful. Come all the way from Los Angeles, every.
Go home now and take the frog out.
Well, any comments in general that you want to make about, as I say, there are many other aspects of the Voice of the Silence that we have not gone into. There is one statement that I have always felt is a particularly beautiful statement, and I haven't given attention to it. It comes towards the end, if I remember correctly, yes. To me, this is the, in a sense, the summation of it. In verse 293, self-doomed to live through future kalpas, cycles, ages, but self-doomed, this is, we have chosen this way. We may not be aware that we have chosen this particular path, but we have. We may feel that it was chosen for us, but there was, we may call a monadic choice, the outset. And so we are self-doomed, unthanked and unperceived by men. But then the phrase that I've always liked, wedged as a stone with countless other stones which form the guardian wall. And this is, of course, the wall that shields mankind from, as it said, still more tragic consequences. A guardian wall that is standing as a bulwark against a complete flooding of the human condition. Such is thy future if the seventh gate thou passest. But this concept of wedged as a stone with countless other stones, that which means that the rough edges are all the time being worn off, aren't they? If we're part of a wall, as stones, the knobs and excrescences are all the time being removed, and we're part of this, and we're here is human relationships, isn't it? That it's constantly sort of making sure that we fit in and not saying, well, I want to be the stone that's on the top of the wall, or I want to be the stone that's nearest the gate that the master walks through, whatever. But just being willing to be wherever in the guardian wall that stone is needed. And I think it's marvelous, built by the hands of many masters of compassion, raised by their tortures, by their blood cemented. It shields mankind, since man is man, protecting it from further and far greater misery and sorrow. But somehow that image has always been very meaningful to me. I don't know if it is to you, but it is an extremely meaningful one. But again and again, you see, can there be bliss when all that lives must suffer? Shalt thou be saved and hear the whole world cry? So that again and again, compassion speaks and saith, and so on, that there is this hearing, this really listening to all that is around us, transmuting it in ourselves by the generosity of our being, and yet being patient with ourselves, patient with others, and yet with a dauntless energy, with a spiritual energy that is never dissipated, because it flows. We are in a flowing situation, a flowing relationship. So I hope that in this series you've begun to feel that the voice of the silence, while it at times seems a rather difficult path, yes, and it's not always an easy one. I have in my book a copy of a little poem by a theosophist of the early part of this century, Ella Wheeler Wilcox. She was a member of the society. And so I put it into my copy because it's rather nice to remind myself of it. And the poem she entitled Climbing. Who climbs the mountain does not always climb. The winding road slants downward many a time. Yet each descent is higher than the last. Has thy path fallen? That will soon be past. Beyond the curve, the way leads up and on. Think not thy goal forever lost or gone. Keep moving forward. If thine aim is right, thou canst not miss the shining mountain height. Who would attain to summits still and fair must nerve himself through valleys of despair. So it's a little reminder to myself that there may be a long way to go, and yet everything is right here and now, and all the possibilities are before us. So we can have courage candidate as one who fears no failure, courts no success. So thank you very much. I have enjoyed it. I hope you all.